Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Now move into a section where Greg's going to argue, I guess, at least in telling his story, he's going to say very bluntly why he's happier outside the church. And Greg, I think you've already said it before, but maybe you'll want to disclaim whatever you'd want to do. This isn't for everybody. You've already admitted that you have a certain temperament that may not match, you know, some of us on this podcast as well as some of our listeners. So that's a disclaimer. But then, KC, we're going to have you argue joys and happinesses that you think are found within the church, if at all possible for somebody temperamentally, and all the different things. Does anyone want to do their disclaimers first, or should I just skip this section? We'll just go right into Greg.
I just want to go on record saying that my approach does work for everyone.
Love it.
You'll see that I'm not. You'll see that I'm not even kidding.
All right. Well, let's just go for it. Disclaim as you want or not, Greg, and then Casey will have you jump in after Greg kind of steps. But all of us feel free to ask Greg questions along the way too.
So the way that this all began, and I guess I'll kind of jump into this is this thing I wrote, and somebody online was kind of even challenging me in a very kind way. It wasn't in any kind of mean way, and she said, "Okay, well, you know, you say you're so happy now, do tell." And so I shot back as I'm wont to do sometimes, and I don't want to read it word for word, but kind of going through this, I hope we can maybe get some comments on kind of whether you think these are bogus or not. But this is, you know, I guess my one large disclaimer is that I acknowledge that this is my experience, that this is my life. And it doesn't, I don't really have a grand scheme at this point for this to be everybody's life. I probably am trying to work away from that. That's probably been, you know, we're making progress on that. So the first item on the list was that I was having anxiety attacks in church. The last time I went to church, I had an anxiety attack until 1 o'clock in the morning, coming out of the things that I was hearing there. I had this feeling that what I had always believed was reality had no correlation with the reality that I was experiencing in life and that I was being able to see and that I was being able to see in other people. And it felt like the Twilight Zone, and it felt like the Twilight Zone in an awful, awful way. And I didn't know about the Leona Iron Rod talk at the time. I didn't know about Mormon stories. I didn't know that there were people having conversations online about Mormonism. I also didn't know about any historical issues. I just didn't know about the uncorrelated world of Mormonism. Mormonism for me was chapel Mormonism at that point. And so it just was driving me crazy. And I say that without reservation. I don't have any of that now. And so, you know, going from a life where this activity is really, in my mind, causing me a lot of anxiety to it doesn't cause me anxiety. And I get to – I'm trying – you know, I get angry sometimes and I get frustrated and I'm very much involved in this conversation about Mormonism and about my life and about how we all approach this. But I am not anxious about it. I'm very much at peace, and I think that peace is a desirable thing. So that was the first one.
So Greg, for you, for your own health, let's get out of this situation. This is a stressor that's I am in full on attack until 1 a.m. and I need to remove myself. So the peace you're talking about here is that, would you say it's a final type of peace, or is it a peace where first thing you got to deal with is remove the pain and then deal with meaning later? that kind of piece?
I've actually taken some of these questions to some degree off the table. So we're not going to be able to address this to the degree that you would want to, but I don't find the question of where God is, who God is, how God is, I don't find that very interesting. I find it to be somewhat unknowable. And so unless he wants to come to my house and talk to me about it, I just don't feel the need to rack my brain over it anymore. So I feel like it's kind of a final piece in that sense. I'm just not looking for answers to questions. I'm not looking for answers to questions that I don't even know how to approach. I have taken on a much, much more humanist standpoint. I will look for divinity among my fellow humans.
Go and, team humanist.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks. So, you know, that's kind of that's like I said, that's a big question. The second thing was, I study things now, and I study a lot of things that I can verify have a beneficial effect in my life, and I don't have to have guilt or reticence because of what I'm reading. I don't have to feel like, oh, how does this fit with this framework that I'm supposed to be believing? And I don't have to feel guilty that I'm not reading my scriptures or reading the same book over and over and over again because I'm reading something else. I read, you know, I don't have to feel like, oh, should I be reading First Nephi for the 40th time as opposed to reading the newest article by Malcolm Gladwell. And that's a big deal. And that creates a lot of richness in my life because those things create richness for me personally.
I just want to back up. There is our Sunday school president in the stake is seriously like 80 years old. And I was a bit appalled when he talked about how he spent literally hours a day reading the scriptures. And he talked about how you could read the Book of Mormon every month. And I was like, are you serious? I mean, so this is what you do with your time when you're retired, and that's fine. But I just want to affirm Greg and what he's saying, that even though there are many people who feel comfortable reading whatever they want, there's a very strong discourse in the church about that you have to read the scriptures all the time. And there are lots – we all know lots of members of the church who will not read anything unless it's published by Deseret Book. I think that's an extreme point of view that's more common in Utah, but it's still there.
Well, I didn't grow up in Utah, and I certainly had that view. The unspoken assumption of all of these points is that this is something I let go of. You know, that I, even if I wasn't very good at reading my scriptures, I felt the guilt of not reading my scriptures and not reading them a lot and not reading them in that way, reading them several hours a day and like getting through them once a month and stuff. I have felt in my life a lot the guilt of not being able to do that. So it's all framed the way that I did it. So I was a terribly unhealthy Mormon. Let's be serious. you know, I was a very devout, very black and white, very unhealthy Mormon. And I don't like who I used to be in that sense. So, you know, but I also would say that I also valued orthodoxy tremendously. So what are you going to do? Number three, you know, it's a funny thing. this is an aside. I won't go into this, but since leaving the church and since stopping paying tithing, I have a much, much better job that pays better, with a better boss, with a better work environment, with better prospects for for advancement. There is nothing about my financial life that is not, and my work life that is not incredibly better since I decided to opt out of the tithing test. That was kind of number three. Number four, and this is one of the – this is maybe the number one reason that I'm reminded of several times a week. I have real friends now. I don't consider myself to be like that onerous of a person, but for years, my wife and I would talk about the fact that we didn't have real friends. And we would try. This has been especially since moving to Utah. When we lived in California, we had a few friends that we felt like were really good friends in the church. But since moving to Utah, we really struggled with that. You know, we're quite okay cooks. We make some good food at our house, and we try to invite people over.
He's
for dinner.
Amazing. He won't say it himself, but he's incredible.
Like. So, and like, we want to have people over for dinner. We want to have friends. We want to, like have conversations and talk about interesting things, and I could not find friends. And I'm just so not interested in talking about the BYU versus Utah rivalry, and I'm not interested in various things that are sort of, you know, that probably make it harder. I want to talk about art and philosophy and indie rock and food, and movies and books, but and not sports. But I just couldn't find any friends, and now I have lots of friends, and they come over all the time, and they hang out for a long time. The church did not serve my social needs in the least bit, and has been a real problem.
Right.
And being an apostate has been fantastic for that. So I would highly recommend apostasy in Utah to anybody. Anybody that's lived in Utah versus other places where the church is relatively strong, being a Mormon in California is affirming. Like, it's a life-affirming thing. You meet other Mormons, and they like you. At least they did before, or other people even. Before Prop 8, being a Mormon in California was, like, a good affirming thing. Being a Mormon in Utah is either zero or negative. So you meet other Mormons, you don't get to be friends with them automatically because you're Mormon, because that's just the norm. So there's nothing notable about it. And it's a highly polarized place. So I probably didn't have people in my life who were like, "Oh, I hate your church," before moving to Utah. Being an apostate in Utah is exactly the kind of support group that you would have had elsewhere. When you're an apostate here and you meet other apostates, you like each other.
Hey, Greg, I'm gonna push on your terminology a bit. I think.
All right.
How about fringe Mormonism?
Okay, fine.
I mean, I know I you like love I you love the word
apostasy.
You love the word apostate, and that's fine. But I agree,
I
and I would, and I, as experiencing someone from the inside, and I know it's not my term, but my turn. I love the richness of fringe Mormonism. I love the richness.
I agree. I like fringe Mormonism.
What I like, okay. What I like even better than fringe is inclusive, which often is on the fringes, sadly. But in inclusive Mormonism, it is so rich. It is so affirming. It is so wonderful. Anyway.
No, I'm okay with that. Cool. And I use apostate to affect, and I'll acknowledge that. Number five is really the word of wisdom. Wine, coffee, beer, whiskey, anything else. I like drinking coffee. I like drinking wine. I like drinking beer. I like drinking whiskey. I like drinking other things. I think that it's normal. In Mormonism, I was taught to think of it as deviant behavior, which is when you think of deviance as deviation from the norm, which is what it means. It's silly to think of these substances being deviant. And I like them. I think you get back to sort of those sociological things. There is a long history of humans messing in small ways with their body chemistry to get effects that they like and that are predictable and that are pretty much harmless. And I like those as well. Number six, better sex life. And I'll probably pound the pulpit on. I don't have to worry about God or his minions or his servants having any opinion whatsoever about my sex life or my children's sex life at all. And I don't think of sex as holy. I have struggled with that concept for years as people were like, "Oh, well, sex is really holy. It's really sacred." No, it's really animalistic and carnal. And that's what I like about it. And so to let go of harmful, damaging teachings about sex, ranging from masturbation to frequency to whatever, I think is fantastic. I also wrote, I recognize that it's really difficult for people to let go of harmful teachings like that. And I have spent a fair amount of effort in my life working through my own hang-ups in that area. But my sex life has only gotten much, much better, and consequentially my marriage has gotten much stronger over the last 5 years as I have become more and more disaffected and theoretically further from the spirit, theoretically further from all the things that should be making my marriage that should be buoying it up. It's been getting stronger and stronger, and I have a better sex life, and I'm really, really underscore really 100,000 times happy about it.
I want to make one comment, Greg, about, and I'm happy for you, of course, about the animalism of sex. I love the way that Elna Baker put it in her recent piece on not being a virgin anymore. And this could be expanded out to libraries, but I really liked the way she put it. She said, sex is simultaneously a very big deal and not.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I think that we do need to give credit for how powerful a force sexuality is in the human experience. And you could call it transcendent because it is bigger than us in a way. I mean, I see what you're saying, but I do think that there's also legitimacy to this idea of respecting the power of sexuality
absolutely.
In the human experience.
No, absolutely. It's the biggest deal. I can't think of anything that I think is a bigger deal. So I love that quote from Elna Baker. Of course, I like Elna Baker. So, number 7, life is now an adventure. Before, it was a straight and narrow path. And I think this is a funny little nuance in English. Straight, S-T-R-A-I-T, not straight, S-T-R-A-I-G-H-T. Straight in that sense means like straight jacket, like restricted. I mean, the word straight means restricted. And, you know, the straight and narrow path is the restricted, narrow path. And life is now an adventure. I am free to make my life in the way that seems the best to me and to create it and to own it and to be responsible for it. And I love that. And that has really been helpful. Number 8. I feel enormous relief to know that God is not concerned about the sexual orientation of his children, that he gave them that sexual orientation in the first place, or the denomination of people around the world. I'm glad to know that he doesn't care whether they go to church or not. I'm glad to know that he doesn't care whether they're gay or not. I'm glad to know that God, wherever God is not misogynistic. I think the world became or a racist. I think the world became a much, much, much more beautiful place when I am not concerned about whether or not people are Mormon and whether or not they have saving ordinances. I think the world is vastly more beautiful. And I'm no longer required to like create a reality based on the vilification of the world. I don't have to pretend that it's getting more wicked. I don't have to try and figure out ways to fit this apocalyptic narrative that's coming up and, you know, the wicked are going to burn and, you know, the walls of the prison are going to come tumbling down. And
did you listen to our podcast? Because we challenged that.
Well, I think that you challenge a lot of things that the brethren might be a little upset about you challenging. So it's not.
It's all within.
I have a hard time validating a version of Mormonism. This is an aside, and this could be edited out. I don't care. Chapel Mormonism to me is Mormonism. So all the other stuff, all the apologetic stuff, the fringy stuff, the Mormon stories and what you're doing and like finding nuances and everything. I think it's nice and it's interesting, but to me, it's not Mormonism. And that's just me, because it's who do you write the check to and who gets up every 6 months and pretends that he's been speaking to God. And that's really what it boils down to. So for me, and so I love Mormonism on the fringes.
So, but would you say the same thing as all of Buddhism is summarized by the people that practice it with prayer flags or something like that? In other words, everyone, you know, for me, I recognize in every other religion that it has these broad arms, and it has a ways to honor people of all different temperaments, whether it's contemplative or scholarly, and that everything has a level that you teach it when you're a child, and then there's deeper levels and things like that. And so for me, for you to say Chapel Mormonism is Mormonism, you're asking me to do something for Mormonism that I'm not willing to do for others. I want to honor every piece of every other religion when I study it, and therefore it just this feels like a very convenient straw person sort of. Okay. Yeah, it's dominant.
No, I mean,
right.
That's,
you're right there. Okay. But it's just like, why am I going to pick this moment out of 180 or 190-year tradition and say this is the one that is Mormonism when all these other things, and especially the invitation by Joseph Smith to have my experience, to dive in and see God yourself, to do all that stuff there, to be, that's the only thing about Mormonism that matters, is he's invited us to have this experience with God, and he hasn't put limits upon what that relationship with God is, and so anything else that stays away from that, even if it's happening to me in my ward, guess what? I can't hear that. I can't hear what they're saying without hearing this deeper roar of my larger experience there at the same time. And when I can, I'll put my 2 cents in there. So yeah, I'm fighting for my Mormonism.
I can hear that, and I totally love that, and I would validate that, and I would say that's one of the reasons why I cannot participate in the Mormon Church, is because I cannot participate in it in that way. This is me, right? And I would say, so if I'm going to push back a little bit on your Buddhism analogy, because I think you've got a great point there.
And I don't.
You don't.
Okay, well, hold on to your horses, mister. Yeah. I think you have a great point there, but I would say that does Buddhism institutionally suppress the knowledge of those other ideas? Because you say like, well, this is, you know, these are stages. Well, no, my bishop is pissed off that I have gotten to this stage. I get total crap from my family about this. My mother is sent, you know, she's weeping about this. So this isn't like, nobody considers this to be my transcendent step. Nobody's happy that I've graduated from black and white faith. You're happy about it. And that's why you and I can have this dialogue, right? And so I don't know that I think that's the problem with that analogy, is that the institutional church that bears that has the placard, that builds the temples, that takes my tithing money and fights battles of hate, they control that conversation. And so I'm going to validate that they control that conversation. I'm going to validate that I did not know that uncorrelated Mormonism existed, and I did not know it by design of the institution. And so I can't really call that part of the institution or part of the – I will call it part of the tradition, and I will say that you're Mormon and I'm still Mormon. I may be an apostate. I'm still Mormon. I would rather – I want to be clear on where I'm at. But you're not – you know, you don't make Tom Monson happy in what you're doing here. He's not overjoyed about it. Especially Dan, that made Packer happy.
Yeah, Dan, I just want to say really quick that your heartfelt appeal, I mean, you know how close you and I are. I mean, we see things very, very – our approach is extremely similar. I just don't think – as Greg said, I don't think Buddhism is the best example. I think that we're more comparable to Southern Baptists, but even more so, or Jehovah's Witnesses, and these traditions where there is much, much more control. So I think that we – I'm with you. I'll get into that a little bit later when it's my turn. I'm with you in claiming the best of Mormonism and shaping our Mormonism. But at the same time, I also think we need to give full acknowledgement and weight to the way that the institution pushes and frames and controls and constrains and so forth.
That's fine, yeah. To me, any human journey seems to have the stage where you define yourself, you grow up, you decide that I'm not my parents, my parents' life and plan for me is not necessarily what it is. I differentiate myself, and I think every institution, every religion points beyond the institutional boundaries. And so whenever somebody says, no, the institution is the religion, I'm going to fight back, because the journey of life says, stand on your own. Eventually you do.
Again, I agree, Dan.
I agree with that.
I agree so much. But the problem is, Dan, would you say, okay, the institutional church, the institutional narrative, do you think it approves or disapproves of your approach?
It disapproves because it's not seeing it, but give me 5 minutes with one of these President Monson leaders and I'll – how's he going to say that I'm not on the journey that the gospel's pointing me towards?
Because they will.
Well, I don't think you will. I don't think you will. I've rarely had a heart to heart with anybody who isn't by the end of it going, oh yeah, I get that.
Your position is defensible. Our position is defensible, Dan, especially yours, but that doesn't mean it's the approach of Chapel Mormonism.
Cool.
Okay, so I mean, you know, there's a lot of things to talk about. Number nine, this is related to, I have an economist brain. I really love the study of economics. And so I think about supply and demand, and I think about commodities, and I think about things. And life is now precious because it is no longer, in my mind, an unlimited commodity. So I'm jealous of my life now, and I'm anxious to engage in it completely to try and use up every last drop. And I don't want to say that Mormons are not, or that, you know, active people who believe strongly are not trying to make their life rich and fulfilling and use it to the best of their abilities. But the Mormon worldview is that life is has an unlimited supply. And so because it has an unlimited supply, the laws of economics say that the value of that supply goes down. And in fact, unlimited means that it would theoretically go down to essentially nothing. So that time has less meaning. Now, I would say that that is practically manifest in a bishop being willing during the formative years of his children's lives to spend 30 or 40 hours out of the home, not being with them, because he thinks he's got all the time in the eternities to be with them or whatever. You know, he's missing valuable time in his children's life. I am happy to say that I'm really trying to stuff it all in as much as possible now and trying to appreciate those moments. It's a bit theoretical, it's certainly a bit abstract, and somebody could call me out and say, well, you know, why were you watching YouTube cat videos?
Greg,
I don't ever watch YouTube cat videos, but I mean, you know, this is hard to enforce, but I think it's a mindset that you have to look at.
I think this is one of the most important points that you could possibly make, because we do hear in the church, we've all heard this example of like, well, you know, if eternal life is a rope, you know, that goes as far as you can see, this life is a knot on the rope. And I won't say which leader, but I heard a very, very high leader in the church make what should have been a joke but wasn't, where he said, in this church, we seal couples for eternity and separate them for time.
Wow.
And that's heartbreaking. And this idea of valuing eternal life over present life also is what makes people blow themselves up.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to make that point.
Jared, you actually had a point that you made in Sunday school a few weeks ago about this that was really close to something that Daniel Kahneman says in that TED talk about decisions and life and how you conceptualize it.
It's a very, very important part of my approach that I'll talk about in a little bit. But the basic idea is, because I agree that scarcity yields value. What is scarce is precious. In fact, the word dearth is the nominal form of dear. So things are dear because they're precious and there isn't much of them. And I very strongly agree that this idea that there is an unlimited amount of family time can be extremely, extremely damaging. So basically, this is part of my approach. But I said in Sunday school, I framed it extremely carefully, but I said, you know, I'm not, this is not an anti-testimony. I'm not making any claims, but I just want to invite you to all have a thought experiment. And if you all, speaking to my Sunday school class, if you all were to come to a sure knowledge that your existence would cease at death, would you live your life the same way? And then I would suggest, if the answer to that question is yes, I would live my life a different way, maybe you should. So that's part of my can't lose win-win approach to Mormonism. I think that if any practice is not justified here and now, it is not worth it. It's too risky a gamble. That the afterlife should be hoped for but not depended on. But again, that's my turn.
Right. Cool.
Okay, we're almost done. So number 10 I'm no longer plagued by the problem of having to discern the desires of an absent celestial parent with regards to my life decisions. I'm free to make the best decisions I can come up with and own those decisions. This came actually over time. A while ago, a few years ago, Dallin Oaks gave a talk about parenting, and he talked about being a parent like Heavenly Father. And he actually was trying to sort of walk a middle road. So I appreciated that about him, but it served to crumble my testimony a little more at the time, because he was talking about, you know, you shouldn't just kick your kids out when they're bad, and you shouldn't just be permissive. You should be a parent like Heavenly Father. And I thought about it. And I was like, well, oh, the primary attribute of God is his absence. So we make up our relationship with him for the most part. You know, people do. And then, you know, hopefully, theoretically, other people have real relationships with them. But God is absent. You know, he's not here. And so you're praying, you're trying to figure out. I've made some colossally terrible decisions because of prayer, where I prayed, tried to figure out, you know, oh, I think I feel the right answer. And they're just terrible, disastrous decisions. So I feel like I make much better decisions now that I don't pray about them, because I'm not trying to feel the cosmos for some sort of, you know, I spin this a little bit in my apostate way, but try to feel the cosmos for some tarot card, like revelatory answer. I just try and figure out the best thing to do and do it. And if it works out, great. And if it doesn't, you know, it's my fault. But I didn't have some like, oh yeah, I think this is going to work out. That's supposed to be confirmatory to my sort of larger feelings of, you know, in that parental sense. Hopefully some other people have better experiences with getting answers to their prayers that don't like blow up their lives than I've had.
Cool.
I'm with you there, Greg, on my first marriage.
Yeah, perfect point. Okay, number 11, and then, this is it. And this is a big one to me, and this is about as big as it gets. I am now under no compulsion to teach or expose my children to harmful teachings about sex or people. I'm also not required to teach them outdated notions about their roles in life. They'll be free to choose their own paths, and I will be free to love them no matter what those paths are. I think there's a lot to unpack there, but there will never come a day when I have to decide because my kid comes out to me that he's gay, or because they are having troubles with whatever. There will never be a day that I have to try and decide whether I'm going to choose my kid over the church. And in so many ways, I know that that gets back to my excessively black and white way of viewing things. I'm just happy to know that I never have to worry about it, that I never have to worry about the heartache that would be. So recognizing that that's my own, you know, my own weakness and a place where I'm at. So
cool.
So that was the list of things that I kind of came up with then. And I really still feel pretty strongly that it's a pretty decent, you know, representation of what I feel like has been beneficial. I thought there was an interesting that thread really turned into a long beast. And one of the interesting things was how many people came back and said in nice ways, because these are people that I have for the most part, a really decent relationship with. And it was all pretty much in good fun, I would say. The whole thing sort of started as fun. So many people came back and were kind of like, well, okay, but you could have had most of those things in the church. Obviously, nobody's going to tell me that I could, you know, just break the word of wisdom willy-nilly within the church or whatever. But they're like, you could have been happy like that in the church. And I'm not saying that that's not possible, but I am saying that it is not my experience. It's not that it's not possible for someone else. It's that I wasn't happy in those ways in the church. And so I thought it was interesting that there was still this, even in a trying to be really open way, there was still this undercurrent of either social discomfort at somebody choosing a different path, or even sort of a sly, like, you know, not sly, a subtle sort of call to repentance, like, you know, well, you're just not doing it right. I think that that feeling is largely unconscious in people. I wouldn't say that anybody was like, oh, well, you know, I got to figure out how to save Greg's soul. My soul is, you know, it's totally lost already, so there's no hope. but that it was just this, you know, when we're as humans, we really like people to agree with us. We really like for, you know, we feel that's a really big component of who we are, and we want to be in that sharing space. It's really hard to accept pluralities of approaches. It's very modern. And so, or postmodern or post-postmodern. And I really felt that there. I felt like, okay, you know, you guys asked me, why am I happy? And I told you, and then you kind of say, well, those don't count so much because you could have been happy in the church still. And that hurt more than I wanted it to, I guess, or I just was annoyed
Greg, I don't want to minimize your hurt in any way. My read
no, that hurt is whiny. It's not like that's a crybaby hurt. It was just annoying, kind of. It's not that I was
Let me. So this is in Mormon 2.0, which is a Facebook book group that spun off of Mormon Stories. And the way that I read those reactions, I acknowledge what you're saying, and it is true that we want to affirm our own view. And one thing dangerous about Mormonism potentially is the investment required is so high that if you make a legitimate – you are a disconfirming narrative, Greg. And that's very
– I am happy to acknowledge that I am a disconfirming narrative, yes.
But now let me give my charitable read about what one thing I think was going on in that thread is because this group is specifically for those trying to navigate their relationship to Mormonism, I think it is an extremely natural thing to kind of use what you shared as a check against each of our approaches where they say, okay – oh, yeah, okay, so these are the reasons you're happy. Could I do this? Could I have this? How many of these could I have from the inside? Do you see what I'm saying? So that as we each try to navigate our relationship with Mormonism in that particular group because of the purposes of it, I think it's natural that we would use you all as a mirror to say, oh, how many of those could I have in the church? So, you know, not surprisingly, it's not about you. It's about us.
I think that's totally fair. In fact, I think that's a really, really wise and better way to look at it than I was. I mean, I would totally agree with that.
Yeah, I thought those great points, Jared. Thank you. It's definitely an interesting thing, and I'll admit reading that thread and just like the same thing. Wow, I didn't take Mormonism that way, so therefore point 1, 2, 3 or whatever it would be, you know, that wouldn't have occurred to me that I, you know, had to look over my shoulder and worry about this or that or something. And so I certainly was doing it as well. So I apologize for any hurt.
Oh, no. No, in fact, I need to retract the hurt thing. It's not really about hurt. It's just, it's kind of that feeling of just, I just think I was taking it in a bad way. On the flip side of that, Dan, you know, you say, well, I wasn't taking Mormonism that way. One of the interesting things, though, is you can, and I know you can, back up the way you take Mormonism with quotes, you know, with doctrines, with solid quotes from solid people on that. But I can totally do the same. So it's not that it's like everyone's a cafeteria Mormon because Mormonism is so vast in its like statements
But
and
again,
its grandeur, and there's so much crap said that like crap and like.
But again, one of those things in a Fowler sort of progression is you become your own authority. You quit worrying about the authority of others, and you don't trade statements. You say which one feels. Which one feels like true and whatnot and stuff like that. So my dueling general authority citations is a game that a missionary would play.
Right.
Whereas adults, we say, come on, the feel of the universe here versus that, the feel of the universe that comes from somebody that said that, come on. You know, and that's where I said I would never, I mean, yeah, I can, and occasionally I do need to throw out a scripture or something that says this is where I'm centering, but it's not because it's in the scripture that I'm centering there. That just happens to articulate what my deep experience is.
Dan,
yeah, I think
but once again, Dan, you know that we share an approach, but we also need to acknowledge the fact that there is not only is there little support for our approach, but there is explicit condemnation of it. there is something that what amounts to me as a denial of agency in Mormonism. You know, the scariest was when Elder Oaks said a year ago that if your personal journey, your personal authority contradicts the institutional authority, it is Satan. I mean, that's there. And I think if I do not think that the institutional church would be friendly toward anyone saying, I am my own moral compass, which is my position. I mean, and it's yours to a degree as well. So anyway, I think we need to acknowledge both sides. I think that what you're saying, Dan, it's within the bounds of Mormonism, but not chapel Mormonism, not Mormonism as it is currently practiced, I don't think. Which is why it's worth fighting for.
And God bless you, Dan Witherspoon, for promoting it. And Godspeed the day that it is the way that it's practiced in the church.
Thanks. So those were good reflections. And Casey, are you... We haven't heard from you in a while, my friend.
Yeah.
So hopefully that means lots of fun thoughts percolating in your brain. Can we just jump in and like, there's no sense here that you need to do 11 points of your own or anything like that. But what's your experience inside the church that says happiness for me is here?
Sure.
Versus where it wasn't possible for Greg.
Okay. So kind of touching on some of the ideas that we covered before in terms of finding happiness in relationships, finding happiness in love, I have kind of centered my religious and my spiritual experiences around building interpersonal relationships and kind of experiencing the divine through building and experiencing those relationships. And so in my current calling, I'm very involved with the recent converts in my ward. And we've actually had, I think, an exceptionally high number of baptisms when compared to maybe averages elsewhere in the church. In the past 2 years, we've had about 25 people come into the ward through baptism.
Wow.
And in kind of seeing, you know, so that's a pretty good spread, and you get a pretty good variety of different personality types and different approaches coming in. And of the people that have been baptized, there have been some that have thrived, that have found a spiritual home, found a community, and really kind of gotten it. You know, felt like they were on track, and then you know got their train moving. Others I've seen flounder, that you know never quite got it, never quite clicked or connected socially or even, you know, with the scriptures or with the teachings. And, you know, we've seen several of them kind of find their path outside of the church. So, you know, in dealing with these people, my own religious experience has been one of, you know, kind of taking the idea of finding the image of Christ in my countenance and trying to assume the role of the good shepherd. And I think, you know, if we get into the ideas of priesthood and you know even proxy work and you know John 15, the vine, Christ is the vine, we are the branches. Or even, you know, recently we had a talk by Elder Uchtdorf where he talked about the statue of Christ with broken hands and the idea that we are to be the hands of Christ or to be the hands of God in bringing forward his work on the earth. That's kind of where I have tried to find my center of gravity as I've, you know, experienced my life in the church and my life interacting with people both inside and outside the church. And in as much as I've been successful in doing that, and I found it's not always successful in really being able to see myself in that role or to be able to sustain that. But I have found that the times that when that has been successful, for whatever the factors may have been, those have been the times in my life that I've felt the most satisfied, the most at peace, kind of on a deep spiritual level in terms of how my soul feels, kind of on a more, I don't want to say metaphysical, but just kind of in a spiritual sense. And that has kind of been an indicator in terms of my happiness. Or I want to say maybe satisfaction or utility in the church and in the gospel. And in as much as I've been able to do that, that's kind of the experience that I encourage others who have come into the church to take, because I believe that's the approach that will, I believe, would be most beneficial to them, to have positive experiences, both experiencing happiness and experiencing satisfaction in their religious experiences. So there are a couple recent converts that come to mind that I'd like to highlight in terms of what their experience has been. One of them was a college girl who had done a couple years in school, had kind of, I don't think it was really working out for her too well, had kind of moved back home to, I think, you know, kind of reorient herself and figure out kind of what she wanted out of life. She was on YouTube one day, and there was a Mormon.org ad that showed up, and she clicked on that and, you know, spent some time lurking on Mormon.org. You know, I think some people wonder, you know, do these ads even work? Well,
right.
After about 3 weeks of lurking, she clicked on the, you know, request a visit from the missionaries, and I actually was on splits with the missionaries and met her for her first visit, and she kind of talked about where she was at, kind of wondering, you know, had some expectations about what college life was going to be like, how she was supposed to find her purpose and life direction, and it just really wasn't working out for her, and she was just kind of asking, you know, so what's the point? What's the point of life? And she had kind of grown up in a secular home, and you know, hadn't had any really religious considerations, which now it seemed like she was drawn towards considering. So we kind of went through the standard, you know, missionary lessons, and she had some positive experiences with the Book of Mormon, and but I think more than that, it was, you know, finding a sense of purpose in her life, and then finding a new community of friends, and you know, now having a new group of people that she could grow with and learn from and share her experiences with. And I know that both her life, her quality of life has increased, and also our ward has benefited from her presence and from her insight. And when I see that happen, that kind of leads me back to the Zion approach of you know, I feel like I'm part of building a community that is achieving something greater. And that's when I feel that satisfaction and that happiness, like, you know, what I'm doing here matters, and then relationships are built and you know, communities and love increases.
Cool. That's, and you know, I know you want to share a second convert sure. story too, but what I've noticed here in this last 10 minutes or whatever, you haven't mentioned salvation, anybody's eternal. You haven't mentioned anything about eternal stakes, which I think is great. Well, you know what I mean? Yeah, you're just talking about true happiness. You're talking about the world stuff.
I would say that is definitely in the backdrop of, you know, how I see this all framed. But yeah, I think, Jared, what was it that you mentioned in terms of the approach that you take? If it isn't...
Yes, if the decisions you're making in a religious context do not justify themselves and bring rewards in this life, it is too much of a gamble. You know, we should not gamble on getting rewards in eternity. And I really love President Hinckley quoted, I think it was Joseph F. Smith, who said, "A religion that does not do a man good in this life is not likely to do much for him in the next," or something. There's a really neat quote about that.
Sure. Okay. So I guess my approach is similar to that. Maybe rephrased in that I don't believe that our afterlife will be glorious or worth living the eternities through, unless we're able to achieve at least an approximation of that on Earth. And I think there's plenty of support for that in terms of, you know, this is the time to prepare to meet God and things like that. So I think, you know, at least the way I approach the big cosmic questions is really to create a microcosm of it and live in that and have that inform the way I would perceive, you know, the afterlife or you know, the more cosmic, maybe intangible things in religious contexts. And I found that very beneficial in terms of kind of keeping me grounded in so I'm not, you know, the hymn that says, get up and do something more than dream of your mansions above.
Right.
You know, those mansions above certainly are a part of my belief system in some way. I don't know if they're actually be mansions, but that certainly is, I don't want to say in the background, but I guess backdrop is a better way to put it, that I see more immediate things that relate somewhat directly to that. And that's where I center kind of my religious focus. And I find that has more immediate, applicable payoffs than kind of keeping things in a more abstract hereafter kind of perspective.
Cool. Thank you.
I have a question for you, Casey. Well, first, a joke. You know that the wealthy neighborhoods of Bountiful and Sandy are but a type and shadow of the mansions in the Celestial Kingdom. Come on, admit it.
Is that right?
Well, so how, if I can ask you a question, how do you view the emphasis on ordinances in Mormonism then? Because it's so much weight and resources are invested in that. I mean, I really like your approach of emphasizing, you know, the relationships and the happiness and the here and now. But how do you, if you're arguing for happiness within the church, how do you justify all of the resources that are spent and even prioritized? I mean, even to the point of, say, talking about temple worthiness or temple attendance over whether all our members have enough to eat. I'm not saying you personally believe that, but when I tried to listen to conference this last time, I just didn't relate, because all the emphasis was on, you know, do this so you can be worthy, you know, pay tithing so you can go to the temple. There's just so much emphasis on the ordinances, and I'm wondering how that fits into your view of happiness.
Sure. So at least in terms of ordinances specifically, so I generally tend to avoid kind of legalistic interpretations of doctrine, or I find the legalistic ways of interpreting things typically are I don't find them quite as useful. But in terms of ordinances, that's one area that I find maybe taking a legalistic approach has some value in that. I guess the way I see it is maybe a bank account and a check, that when you sign a check, you know, you have to go through the ritual, if you will, or of signing the check. And, you know, there has to be authority and things like that to make that valid. So it is I guess signing a check is a necessary step, but signing a check doesn't put money in the bank. So I see kind of the stuff I was emphasizing before in terms of love and relationships, I think that's the real money in the bank. And in terms of how I see ordinances, I see that more as the signature on the check, which to some extent is necessary, but I have a hard time seeing that as the actual substance of what's going on.
That's a powerful analogy, actually. I really enjoy that. It's a very powerful analogy. One of my issues is I do not think that theologies should need to be true to justify their investment, but that's, you know, that's something different. But I very much like that analogy. That was a good explanation.
Well, thanks.
Cool. So feel free to continue your second story of a different convert besides
Sure.
the college student.
Yeah, another one was referred by her high school friend, who had also recently come into the church, and she seemed to come in with a little bit of apprehension. I think was Catholic or Christian as a child, but hadn't really had much religious exposure in her young adult years. And her mother had passed away. I'm not sure quite how long before she joined the church. But in time, I'd say not quite a year after she was baptized, she was able to go to the temple and be baptized for her deceased mother. And, you know, she was one who had a hard time reading scriptures, and you know, the language was difficult, and sometimes the concepts were. And she wasn't so much grounded in, you know, priesthood and keys and spirit of Elijah and, you know, sealing power and things like that. But as she was able to participate in this ordinance, it was a way of her paying tribute to her mother in a very unique way that I don't think she really could have gotten any other way. That she felt a rekindled connection with her mother and was somehow, you know, able to interact with her in, you know, both through her memories and through her heart, but also in this new religious framework where she had the hope of meeting her mother again and being sealed to her. And that was the source of a great deal of happiness to her, even in her, you know, limited understanding of, you know, the doctrinal details and everything. It brought a good deal of utility to her life and increased the quality of her life and was a powerful way for her to pay tribute to her mother and remember her.
Yeah, it's neat.
Another one was actually a guy who was homeless. He was actually pretty young. He had been from shelter to shelter, but the first times he came to church, you know, was he looked homeless, you know, and of course that usually makes members in white shirts and tie kind of recoil with a little bit of, you know, apprehension. And everyone kind of wondered, you know, what's with this guy? Is he for real? And then it was announced that he was going to be baptized. And you kind of sense this, you know, this discomfort of, you know, is this going to last? Is what's going to happen here? But this guy stuck with it. And, you know, through the bishop and we have a housing coordinator and some other things, we're able to get him a more stable place to live and got him cleaned up in terms of appearance. And then he was able to reconnect with his mother and his brother, who they had some strained relationships, and they came into the church too. And now as a family, they are closer as a family than they've ever been before. And him coming into the church was really the first spark to reconnecting them and giving them a renewed sense of purpose and direction and meaning in life. You know, so I think that was probably the most dramatic demonstration of increased quality of life in terms of a convert. And that's, you know, I'm that brings me happiness to know that I was a part of that. And I believe that those types of activities are worth pursuing and worth fighting for. And this is, you know, this brings us closer to this, you know, more abstract, idealized, you know, utopian Zion. That again, as we keep that as a, you know, kind of directive to move towards, I think everyone benefits therefrom. So that's. Those are kind of the stories of the recent converts that at least have brought happiness to me as I've seen them also achieve happiness.
Love it. Yeah, thank you. That's really fantastic.
I totally love that. That last story is like pure religion, undefiled as this. You know, I mean, those are fantastic examples, and I really appreciate sort of being able to get out of my own little box as well and hear you kind of give those, because I think it's helpful to me.
Yeah, and the second one was the only one where you really say uniquely Mormon. You know, really that way of honoring her mother is probably the only one of those that kind of Mormon only could have done it. But the rest is, like Greg just says, pure religion undefiled. That's what it's all about.
Sure.
Even though the uniquely Mormon idea of honoring your mother and stuff, I mean, that's a persistent theme in religion through the history of religion, right? Is this ancestral homage. And there's something really touching about that as well. And I would say, you know, I probably won't be showing up next Sunday still, but that feeling of not of some disconnect kind of from my family, I can talk about the things that make me sad about this as well as the things that make me happy. And that's definitely that disconnect or that feeling of sort of disconnect even from who I am, you know, that's a real thing too. So I really appreciated that story too. And even in it, if you say, you know, Dan, and it's unique Mormonness.
Yeah, you're right. It isn't exactly unique, but it felt really Mormon compared to the others.
Sure.
But no. Neat. Well, Casey, I want you to do whatever you want to do now as far as just sharing. Is your approach really all things being equal, if somebody can stay within the church, here are some really neat reasons why? Or how would you sort of articulate yourself in relationship to Greg? Because he's not saying that everybody is like him temperamentally, everyone had the same experience there. So what would you say as far as like an urging or before you do anything drastic, somebody else, here's my best stuff?
Okay. Maybe one way to start out would be, and Greg, you mentioned this just a second ago, about how to deal with sadness or discontentment of one way or another within the church. And also the idea of if you're not happy, you're doing something wrong or there's something wrong with you. You know, we equate the gospel and righteousness with happiness so much that I think there's an important aspect that's often overlooked. And that is kind of the role of frustration, of tension, of sadness, and of maybe grieving and mourning or other types of disconnects that I believe have a place within the gospel. And one thing I like to point out is, you know, take again, kind of going back to the scriptures, you take someone like Nephi, who you read the narrative and he seems the epitome of righteousness, yet he experienced a lot of sadness in his life. I mean, even unrelated to his family breaking up and you know, whatever abuses he suffered through in his psalm, the Nephi psalm, he just talks about, oh, wretched man that I am, just feeling like he's not measuring up and kind of feeling the, I guess, kind of depressed feelings of, you know, this, he doesn't explicitly say that it's not working for him, but obviously there was something going on that was keeping him from kind of this complete bliss that one might expect from a pinnacle of righteousness that's in the scriptures. So we see, I think even in, towards the end of 2 Nephi, I might have to look this up, but he says that he waters his pillow at night, you know, talking about his people. And we see even Jesus saying, groaning and mm-hmm. and having kind of the sadness for the people. And I think that probably the most dramatic example is Mormon at the end. He has this huge lamentation of, O ye fair ones. And here Mormon was a righteous man, but experiencing all kinds of frustrations and dissatisfaction. And the idea that the Book of Mormon is essentially a tragedy, I think that's very important to consider, that happiness, especially, you know, sometimes the happy-go-lucky image that's often associated with Mormons, you almost wonder where does that come from? Because a lot of what we have, you know, as scripture and as founding documents, is laced with sadness and frustration and destruction and, you know, I guess voices of warning. So with that in mind, maybe one sensible way to think about these things would be, when we do feel frustrations in community or in our religious experience or in the church, maybe there are ways that we can grow from it, maybe lessons in humility. And again, this isn't to say that that's, you know, universally true, or that, you know, the remedy to anything would be just buck up and you'll be fine. But I think there is some room for maybe considering frustrations we experience are part of a greater plan. And I think Jared was mentioning, you know, things that we have to work towards and put effort towards might not be generating immediate happiness, but
right.
You know, have kind of payoffs. And there is some danger in saying, oh, well, I'll just be happy later if I can just get through this, and then kind of go through your life without ever having experienced any joy. And, you know, Greg, to your point about the scarcity of time, you know, there certainly is a balance there. But you know, at least in the way that I've approached things, when I focus on relationships and community and see that as a lens towards the divine and towards what I want to achieve and what I want out of a religious experience, I find that a lot of other issues become more peripheral and maybe more tolerable, and kind of keeps me grounded in the direction that I hope to see my life go.
Very cool.
All right, and one more thing is, Marlon Jensen had a talk some time ago, which was called Living After the Manner of Happiness. And in his conclusion, he says, of what use is the gospel, the church, or its organizations and programs, or the way of life it espouses, if we are not happy? I think that that's a very powerful point in terms of bringing the importance of happiness back into the here and now, as opposed to, you know, tolerating misery now and hoping for happiness later. And he quotes Moroni, who with the scripture that usually isn't used in this context, but I think it's very interesting. It's the one that says, you know, we're talking about the judgment. He that is filthy shall be filthy still. He that is righteous shall be righteous still. And he that is happy shall be happy still.
Mm.
And he that is unhappy shall be unhappy still.
Interesting.
So I think there's, you know, an important, even, you know, scripturally based case to make that it is our challenge and duty to create a happy setting and a happy life now. Because if we're unhappy now, you know, and if we're looking forward to the afterlife, then the scriptures say we're going to be unhappy still there too. So the final thing that comes to mind for me is the closing number in the Book of Mormon musical.
You know, you quote Moroni, and now you're quoting South Park, Trey and,
sure,
and Matt.
Yep, and kind of the premise of that is kind of de-emphasis on doctrine and belief, and more focus on utility, and you know, did the missionaries bring a better, happier life to the Ugandans? And you know, the final number is, you know, I'll just read a few lines from it. It says, I am a Latter-day Saint. I help all those I can. I see my friends through times of joy and sorrow. The skies are clearing and the sun's coming out. It's a latter day tomorrow. Put your worries and your sorrows and your cares away and focus on a latter day. Tomorrow is a latter day. I am a Latter-day Saint along with all my town. We always stick together. Come one more. We'll be here for each other every step of the way. Why are Mormons happy? It's because we know it's a latter day tomorrow. So if you're sad, put your hands together and pray that tomorrow is going to be a latter day. So, you know, again, that is, you know, kind of looking forward to an afterlife, but there also is the value of making, you know, making this our paradise planet, and the importance of kind of finding happiness now and having that kind of dictate our religious experiences.
Very cool. Thank you. Do you have more in your kind of just basic orientation to life, or should we move on to hear Jared and his crazy stuff?
Yeah, I think that's what I got to offer for now.
Cool. Well, Jared, I don't mean crazy stuff. You've thrown some provocative things out there pre-call as well as something here on the call. So let's go for it.
Sounds good. So first, I know this has gone long, but I really think our listeners are going to love this episode. I appreciate you, Dan, going. I feel like this episode is kind of out of the comfort zone of Mormon Matters. So my approach to Mormonism can't lose, and it is for everyone.
Love it.
And that is because it is living Mormonism the way it works for you individually. Everyone. And so, as I said, there's no way for it to lose. But there are tensions and difficulties. This requires something that I call enlightened self-centeredness. Because there is a lot of social pressure and institutional pressure to live Mormonism in a certain way. And I don't do anything because I'm told to. There are a few things like speed limits and stuff, but you know, just in general, I like to do things for reasons. I like to understand reasons for things.
And so as I've been on my faith journey and things have deconstructed, I wonder, like, well, why should I do this or why shouldn't I do this? And I only, first, I love what you've said, Casey, and I love your approach, Dan. And so I believe that Mormonism can be framed in a way that is extremely beneficial. I actually think that Mormonism has the potential to survive and thrive in the massive shifts in the religious and spiritual worldview. I see a Mormonism that could embrace the idea of modern revelation, of innovation, of adaptation, of taking everything good, and that could be the watchword. That could be the defining nature of Mormonism. But will it? Probably not. That said, and I'm going to make a provocative statement here that kind of shocked me even when I said it out loud. I think that the institutional church, as it is now, is doing more harm than good. And that breaks my heart. Like, I think for a lot of people, the church does more good than harm. But I think as an aggregate, it is doing more harm than good. And so I'm at tension. I ask myself, how can I be a part of this? How can I be a part of this church? And for the record, I am an active Temple Recommend holding member. And we go most weeks when we're not sick, which we've been a lot, or we're not going to another service. But there are things taught in the church that I feel morally obligated to stand against. I am against the damage that the church does with homosexuals. I am against the reduction of the ability to think for yourself. I am against the overwhelming patriarchy. Like, I wonder whether it's possible for a woman to be genuinely happy in the church as it is now. Again, I realize that's a very strong statement. So on one side, I like how you said, you talked about utilitarianism and utility, Casey, because that is one of the core principles of my approach, is it has to work. If it works, that's enough. You know, I don't care about the mythology or the theology or the cosmology. I don't care whether it's correspondingly true. I care what works. I care the benefits or the harm that is done in life. And so I say, live a Mormonism that it does every good thing. And now, I'm not advocating a lack of discipline. I'm not advocating unrestrained hedonism. I think that we do need a moral framework. I think that we do need a way, you know, our positions need to be defensible. But at the same time, I think that we have the right, that Dan, you and I, and all of us have as much right to define Mormonism as anyone else, including the people in authority. Now, let me play this out just for a few minutes. So, and I want to be really careful about how I talk about my personal application of this, because these are things that are sacred to me, and they're things that could be easily criticized. So I don't know how specific I will be. I'll use a safe example, though. I was at, we were on a road trip, and we were with my in-laws, and I totally straight up ordered some iced tea, which technically is against the word of wisdom, right? But I think it's absurd the way that most Mormons live the word of wisdom. And so I want to, very briefly, the way that I live Mormonism is I live Mormonism the way that I think it should be, not as it is. So that does put me at tension. And so, for example, the word of wisdom, I love the spirit of the word of wisdom. I try to live that, the principle of the word of wisdom, which is to live in a healthy way. But the way that most members live the word of wisdom is it's hypocritical, it's ineffective, and it leads to judgmentalness. And this is not good. And so I want to live the word of wisdom in such a way that doesn't have those disadvantages. For example, I think one function of the word of wisdom is social distinctiveness. You know, as soon as someone says, oh, I can't drink coffee with you, you're like, oh, are you Mormon? And people see that as a good thing. But I just don't agree with that. I really resonate with what Paul said when he said, when I am with the Jews, I live as a Jew. When I'm with the Gentiles, I live as a Gentile. And I don't want to make it sound like I have no moral framework, because I really do. but I'm not going to do something just because it's the standard interpretation. And so I'm going to speak on two levels. First, as long as you have this enlightened self-centeredness, as long as you are you, and what I mean by that is that we feel a peacefulness and a strength based in our own decisions that we have come to, and that we feel peace with the way we are living our lives, and that we think that is defensible. You know, that a clear conscience before God. And I think that if we have a clear conscience before God, that's more important than the traditional standard interpretations of the church. And I want to make a point that if you are willing to give up your temple recommend, you can live Mormonism however you want, right?
Right.
But I would go even farther than that. And I would say, if an individual feels worthy to go to the temple and is living Mormonism in a way that they feel is in good conscience and living true and healthy principles, they have the right to do what they need to do to have it always. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, for example, I think that the way that sexuality is taught in the church is harmful and damaging. I think that sexuality is sacred. There you go, Greg. I think this idea of a sacred sexuality has power. And I think that sexuality needs to be treated very, very carefully. But I do not agree with the church's standard approach to it. So I'm not going to live that way. And granted, you know, with me being married, it's kind of a moot point. But with the way that I teach my children, it's going to be my way. And I think that's defensible. And so I will, again, I want to say this really, really carefully, but I would feel justified in maintaining my temple recommend, even if I lived in a way that I found ethical and moral. But I would be confident that pretty much every priesthood leader would disagree with me. And I'm going to, so a counter argument, and I understand this. So someone would say to me, well, don't you feel like if you're going to be in the club, you should obey club rules? So don't you feel like that in and of itself is enough of a reason to toe the party line? I'm going to give another example, tithing. I think it is unethical to pay tithing the way it is demanded by the church. And so I'm not going to. I think that the way that I want to pay tithing is I want to give 10% of my increase to causes that God would approve of. I want to give my money to places that give clean water to those who don't have it. I want to feed the hungry. I want to live according to the principles of Matthew 25. I want to do God's work. And something that breaks my heart is so many people sacrifice, so many members sacrifice. Disclaimer, this is not Mormon Matters advocating don't pay your tithing. It's not. This is my personal perspective. But it breaks my heart when I see so many caring, good people give money to the church when they think it equals giving money to God, and it doesn't. And so because I morally and ethically do not feel good about how the church, for years, for most of my life, I just had trust. And this is one particular issue. I'm like, well, you know, I think for the most part, tithing does good. And I trust it. I trust the system, and I don't anymore. So I am taking it into my own hands, and I will live tithing in the way that I find ethical. And so when my bishop asks me in tithing settlement or a temple recommend interview, do you pay full tithing? I feel perfectly justified in saying yes. And we will give some to the church because we, as long as we participate in it, but I have to live it in the way that I think is ethical. And this also relates to my children. My oldest, all my children, I say, you will hear things in church that I don't agree with and that I do not think are healthy. And so I will stand up against that. And so on one hand, sometimes I feel like a double agent, you know, living Mormonism as an active member at tension with the messages. But like you, Dan, and I'm not trying to put you and I on the same page. I own my choices. I give you your choices. But one thing that I think we're on the same page on is that we also have that right to define Mormonism. We have the right to fight for and claim our definition of Mormonism, and that has a sacredness and a legitimacy to it. And so I would say to everyone, live Mormonism in the way that works for you. Live Mormonism. And I am advocating a thoughtful, examined Mormonism. I am not advocating for I want to have an affair, so I'm going to define Mormonism in such a way as I think that's okay. I mean, I do think it needs to be a thoughtful reason that this is not careless, it's not lazy, it's not hedonistic. But I really do stand up for this whole do Mormonism in a way that makes you happy. And so to that, and I acknowledge that for a lot of people, Mormonism straight up works, and I love everything. And so I feel like I am fighting for, so to finish up the thought, on one hand, I feel like a double agent, but on the other hand, like you, Dan, I feel like I am laying claim to uniquely and deeply Mormon principles in the way that I live my life. And so that's how I would defend it.
Very cool. Thank you very much for being so bold. We've had the Temple Recommend question stuff come up several times in here, and it's always one of the most difficult ones. And I'd say you've articulated the strongest case yet for none of your damn business. I'm defining it. I think you should give me a recommend. But on the other hand, you said you have to be willing to give that up and realize that you may not convince somebody else.
Correct. And so I will go out on a limb and I will say I would claim every single one of Greg's happiness points.
As possible within the church.
Yep.
Greg, how do you feel about that?
Oh, I'm probably totally fine with that. I think that the real place where I would completely validate Jared's model is people have said to me kind of in that idea of, well, you know, don't you think an organization has the right to define, you know, who can be a member and who's in good standing and things like that? And my response is not when I'm born into it. No, not when this is my family and my heritage and my who I was born into. You know, I didn't seek membership. So no, you're not allowed to define me in that way. You're not allowed to tell me whether I can be Mormon or not.
Yeah, and Dan, I do. You kind of said this, but I want to reaffirm it. I think that one important part of my ethics and ethics in general is I am willing to accept full consequences for my actions.
Right.
At the same time, I defend the right to minimize the chance that those consequences will come up. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, if I am called in and asked, you know, so let's just put it out there. Let's say that my bishop hears this episode of Mormon Matters.
Right.
And was like, Jared, you know, I have some questions about what you've been saying. You know, will you explain your position? And I would. But at the same time, I respect the approaches. I do not put my approach before anyone else's. I do not. Notice that I said, live Mormonism in the way that makes you happy, in the way that is meaningful to me. I am fighting tooth and nail for my place in Mormonism. I am fighting for the value and the legitimacy of Mormonism. I have ideas that I think would enable Mormonism to thrive over the next 50 years when we will see the atrophying of religion. I will fight for it. I will be an advocate. And so one way that I am not Mormon is I don't believe in the Mormon ordinances, you know. But one way that I am Mormon is I really believe in the value of it. I am on the church's team, even when the church is not on its own team. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, I will stand up for what I think is healthy and good and effective and affirming, and I will condemn what I see as damaging. And it's kind of like tough love toward the church. And one of my resolutions, and this podcast, I've actually been worried about it, Dan, because I realized the position I would put myself in by being so honest and so clear about where I stand, is I feel morally obligated to stand up for myself and to stand up for what I feel is right and what I feel is wrong in the church. And I will not flinch from that. And if it costs me my membership, it costs me my membership, but I don't think it will come to that. And at the same time, I will do everything I can to bring as much love. Do you see what I'm saying? I will mm-hmm. fight for everyone's legitimacy, for every position, and I want to reach as many people as I can for as long as I can. And that is why I stay in the church.
Thank you. Lot to digest there, brother. Oh, man. Yeah, that's the boldest presentation of that I think we've had on Mormon Matters. It does exceed my own comfort level on temple recommends in terms of, you know, the behavioral stuff. I've tended in my own brain to declare my own worthiness based upon, you know, on ideas and how I support this or that or the other things, but I wouldn't expect to get one disobeying the word of wisdom or not paying tithing.
I understand. I fully understand that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was talking to a good friend about the ethics of tithing, and I really like what he said. He said, if it ever comes to a priesthood leader questioning my worthiness, I want them to have not a doubt in their mind that they are only doing it over orthodoxy, because I am absolutely 100% orthoprax. And so, and I really respect that. I really, really respect that.
Very cool. As we've been kind of talking here, this whole personal section, have we lost the happiness thread? I mean, Casey, you were talking about these are the moments that you are the most happiest. Jared, how's your happiness tied to all this stuff that you've been declaring?
Okay, so it's a good question, Dan. You know, how do these personal stories and how does my approach relate to happiness? Is the way it's so resilient and flexible, and it's win-win and it can't lose, is because you follow your happiness. You follow the truth. You follow the goodness. You follow joy. So the way that I view salvation is a maximization of love, peace, joy, freedom, and growth. And by freedom, I mean consciousness, enlightenment. And I follow those. And I think those are the path to happiness. So I am living my life as carefully as I can in the way that I feel will maximize my happiness. I will not, and I'm talking deep happiness. You know, I'm not talking easy happiness.
Well, so what brought you to the ability to define your boundaries and to take these stances on your own? Because we had a little bit of our pre-discussion was, is happiness partly boundary drawing? You know, not letting an institution overwhelm you, drawing healthy boundaries there. And there was a little bit of a sense that we have to be very careful when we talk about this because we don't want to blame the victims who can't draw the kinds of boundaries that you're dealing with here. So what would you give advice to people of, you know, was this years in the making to get to this perspective? How did you detach yourself from the emotions that led Greg to anxiety or whatever? How did you get to this point where you're able to feel this?
Yeah, it's important. And part of why this approaches happiness is, if you are not happy in the church, you need to find a way to be happy. For some people, many people, that will mean leaving. If I were gay, I'd probably be gone. If I were a woman, I might be gone. So to answer your question, I mean, it's kind of, I just feel like through a combination of personal experience, remember we talked about our individual makeup and what was the word we were using?
Temperament.
For it. Temperament. I think my temperament, I think being in a grad program with religion is part of it, but I think a really big part of it is temperament. And not to be too personal, but I was really neglected growing up. And I think I have a fierce self-centeredness that has really helped in this approach. Does that make any sense? Like I have matured in that I now care about other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a long time I didn't as much as I it took me years to get to a point where I really cared what other people were feeling. Caring what other people think, less so.
Right.
You know, so I think it's a combination, and I want to do good with it. You know, I want to serve people, and so I want to write a whole book about my approach to religion, but it's really, you know, owning your own worldview and owning yourself. And one thing that I feel like I haven't been able to give as much justice to in this conversation is respect toward the community. Because when I speak so strongly, you know, almost like flipping off priesthood leaders, it's not that, but you can get that approach where I'm like, well, I'm going to live Mormonism my way, and I'm going to have a temple record on my terms. In order to balance that, I need to express how much I respect community and how much I respect relationships, and that really this my approach to Mormonism that could be considered lying and deceptive and duplicitous, part of it, and people can call me out if they think I'm being self-deceptive, but part of it is really a respect for the other's journey.
Right, right.
Now, one thing I feel is important to say is I want to make it really clear that this approach that I've been talking about, you know, own your own Mormonism, live Mormonism the way it works for you, it also includes and affirms the standard approach. I want to be so clear and underline that I'm not saying everyone needs to rebuild Mormonism from the ground up. I do think that everyone should ponder important questions about morality. I think that's an important part of, you know, being alive and engaging. And we know historically the problems of just, oh, I'm going to do whatever someone tells me to because authority said I should. But I feel like the standard Mormon narrative has room within this, that we should take these principles to God in prayer and have confirmed their truth and goodness. So I think that that's one thing that we hear all the time, that you should pray about things. And for all those people who get the answers that, yes, this is good and true and you should follow it just as is traditionally taught, I respect that, and I think that's great. So traditional wisdom is there for a reason, and correlated Mormonism works for many people. I'm concerned that some listeners may not get that from me enough. So I do want to say that some do need it precisely as is. Chastity can be taught completely from within the standard paradigm and have great benefits, especially if we approach it from a perspective of sacredness and responsibility rather than guilt and shame, which a lot within the standard paradigm would agree on. There are benefits, great benefits, to living the word of wisdom as is normally interpreted, though we might also want to remember the need to eat more whole grains and fruits and vegetables, which is also in there.
Yep.
And there are far worse places to put your money than tithing and fast offering. I really believe that. So if you believe in the value of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the institution, it does deserve to be supported. Again, the concern I have is this automatic, unreflective giving to the church automatically means giving to God, and it's automatically good. But still, I want to say that, you know, there are much worse things to do with your money. And I also stress that I affirm the temple recommend approach, especially if done in a conscious way that avoids potentially damaging elements, which a lot of thoughtful Orthodox orthoprax members do. So the main point is I also support other thoughtful, ethical approaches to Mormonism. And these can also be sacred and worthy, forged through reflection and personal experience. And so I affirm the judgment of member as well as leader. So I wanted to be really clear that when I say it's tautological, but in that way powerful, that the approach that I advocate works for everyone because it includes all approaches. You know, includes all the approaches that have been discussed in this podcast.
Yeah, no, I think it came across, but I'm glad for this clarification too, because you did give us a lot to chew on there, and a lot that, like, a lot of people go, whoa, what's going on here? So I appreciate that, and I think everybody who's heard you over the course of these podcasts and other forums and stuff get that about you, that that you're terrifically open to whatever really it is that brings people happiness. But the thing I like about you, Jared, and I think that if people can simply be patient with themselves to say, I'm no Jared Anderson, or whatever it would be in terms of, I don't quite have that confidence. I think just, again, I love it when I can get you to reflect on how hard a process was this for you to get to.
It's so hard to say because I have no basis of comparison, because none of us have ever been someone else, if that's not too philosophical.
Yeah, yeah. But maybe is it just an assurance? It didn't come all at once. Lots of false starts and stops.
Okay.
Those are the kinds of things
right.
That I like.
One thing that I do want to emphasize is this was a process of many, many years. And I have had a few very painful experiences where it has blown up in my face. In fact, I usually don't talk about this at all, but I was engaged between my divorce and my marriage to Katrina. And this exact approach caused that relationship to explode, basically, which in hindsight was a very, very positive thing. I mean, I'm deeply grateful that things worked as they did, but that was a tremendous learning experience for me. But I think that's an important part of life that we need to affirm, is we do make mistakes. And, you know, even in church, you've heard those fun quotes where it's like, we came to this earth for the privilege of messing up. So I think that's what you're trying to get at, is yes, it took, I do think that because of my makeup, this is something that comes easily to me as far as like thinking through these issues and figuring out, you know, what's the essential and what's the non-essential and what are the principles behind all these things. But it also has been a long process of, you know, trial and error and figuring things out and some painful life lessons, as I alluded to. So one thing that I hope, and I really embrace the value that everyone brings to the table. You know, yes, not everyone is, you know, Dan Witherspoon or Jared Anderson or Greg Rockwell or Casey Kern, but they don't need to be, you know, and I love what we can learn from everyone's journey. And yes, you know, I have different strengths and weaknesses than everyone else, but there's also so much that I can learn from other people and other approaches. And one thing that I hope to do by expressing myself so clearly is to formulate and to try to put into words things that might resonate with other people and that other people can adapt to their own proclivities and tendencies.
Right. That's good.
And personality.
And all that. Yeah. Excellent.
I mean, I want to share with people as much as I can, but I am very, very careful in the way that I disclose this. And that's why it's stepping out on a limb so much, Dan, in order for me to be this open on Mormon Matters. And it is out of respect and love for the Mormon Matters audience, for the Mormon Stories audience, that I am this honest and real about where I'm coming from. But in church and in general, whenever someone asks me something or comes to me, I try to figure out, I'm like, well, what do you want? What do you need? Where are you coming from? And this enables me to personalize my approach to whomever I'm talking to. It is my personal makeup. And I consider Greg a best friend. You know, we have become very, very close. And I think he can attest to the fact that I do not think, I don't judge people. I don't judge people for, I mean, I don't think he would get any like, well, I can do this and you can't, so my way is better. I have a sincere, I really want everyone to do what they need to do in order to get happiness.
Very good. Thank you very much. I think if nothing else, we've modeled four distinct voices, different experiences. And, you know, if the reason that somebody came to this podcast this time was wrestling with this decision, I think we've accomplished the good goal of it's complex. And there's lots at stake. Not so much, I don't think any of us really emphasized eternal stakes in terms of salvation or, you know, any kind of God that is a jerk. But I think we've shown that community and relationship must be kept in mind, but also our own health, our own ability to walk in this world in a way that gives us both that experiential happiness that I can't remember the guy's name, Canahan or what is it, Greg? The experiential Canahan. Happiness as well as the reflective happiness. You know, I think that. Those are key points here. So, yeah, I don't know what I would add to any of this. So, we've gone the rounds. Did anybody have anything that feels like it would serve as a good summing up point for what they think happened in this podcast, and an invitation to the listeners to engage us?
I have one more plea. I understand the complexity of the institutional church affirming the variety of approaches that have been expressed on this podcast. It's almost like the military justifying desertion. Do you see what I mean? That no matter how valid, and I don't like the war analogy for religion, I don't, but there's a parallel here. The military, no matter how valid the reason for a soldier to leave the war could be, the institution, for its own health and benefit, cannot validate desertion. But I really wish that we could hear a talk in General Conference that would say, don't abandon your family members, you know, because they approach things differently. Don't divorce your spouse because he or she lost his or her faith. Don't disown or disavow your children because they view differently. And I think it can be done. I think it can be done in a way that does not minimize the Mormon position at all. I think I would love to see a statement in General Conference, something like, we believe that Mormonism is the surest way to happiness, and we believe that it is a value and there is reason to be in the church and participate in the church, but, or and, love and relationships are the most important thing to God. And Jesus reached out. So do not ever, and this is, I think Jesus would say this if he were here, if he were in Mormonism, I think he would say, do not ever let the details of observance or even theology diminish your love for those most important to you.
Amen.
Very good.
I want to say that that's the most Jesus-like statement that you could come up with. I mean, it's so in line with the New Testament and so in line with the needs of the world that we live in. I just so appreciate that. I want to say, Dan, I just want to say I really appreciate being invited to come on here. I know that I do not represent your sort of typical participant, and that I'm in a place that's different and maybe even troubling. And I appreciate the opportunity to come on and to express my thoughts on this and to participate with Casey and you and Jared, where I have really felt like this conversation has, as you said, enumerated four approaches that are different and that have, you know, they have their own problems. They're complex. I think acknowledging the complexity of life is a beautiful, difficult thing. So I just really appreciate being allowed to participate. It's been great for me. So thank you.
Well, loved having you. And again, it's so strange to host opinions that, you know, I want to fight with you because I find the fighting, you know, a show of respect, you know, that we can take each other on and not take it personally and we can go after it. But it is hard to play the host. And I think I stepped over the line quite a few times today with,
like, oh, no, you're totally fine.
Thank you, Greg. And thanks for your graciousness. And
Dan,
I love to engage.
Dan, I just want to say that I would not be surprised if this episode goes down as a very important one.
Well, good. I hope so. Casey, jump in with any final thoughts, if you would.
Sure. I'd just like to first comment on what was said earlier about the importance of relationships and maintaining relationships. And as I've tried to communicate, I believe that's a very important part of religious experience, is experiencing God and spirituality through relationships with other people. So in terms of making that a priority, I think that's certainly something I could get behind. And just to wrap things up on my end, there's one interesting quote that I did pick out that I haven't been able to share yet. It's kind of interesting, but kind of relates to the overarching themes of everything we've been talking about. It's by Heber C. Kimball from the good old Journal of Discourses.
Woohoo!
And he says, I am perfectly satisfied that my Father and my God is a cheerful, pleasant, lively, and good-natured being. Why? Because I am cheerful, pleasant, lively, and good-natured when I have his Spirit. He is a jovial, lively person.
I like it.
You know, in terms of a concept of God that's is an embodiment of these, you know, of happiness, And also, as it applies to us back in the here and now, you know, as we seek to commune with God through our experiences and through the Spirit, you know, I think that's an attribute that we should strive to obtain also is happiness and experience God through experiencing happiness. I think that's a worthwhile goal also.
Very cool. Thank you very much. Great wrap up. Well, guys, we did one. It's going to be a two-parter, and I appreciate all of your endurance, and we've had quite the eventful time together tonight. But thank you very much for sharing. Jared, honor your risk that you're taking, and we trust that our audience will too, and we'll recognize that this is something for them and not necessarily to be shared beyond their own hearts and close loved ones. Does that make sense? Is that a good way to phrase that?
I appreciate that.
Yeah, so we're throwing out some trust back here. But hey, guys, well, thank you very much. Listeners, thank you for engaging. I have a feeling this one might cause quite a stir on the blog. So Greg and Jared and Casey, if you guys can come to the blog every few days or every day or so and engage people, I know they'll really appreciate that. So
I'll be there for sure.
Cool, cool.
Absolutely.
And everybody, thank you. It's the end of last year, and I did receive some really neat donations there that I know a few of you got under the tax deduction thing, but we will keep records. So any donations that come our way all year is always tax deductible. And we thank you for whatever you do, and just your notes that come along with some of these donations really serve as a great lift to me in doing this. It's a work that I want to do, and I will continue to do. But to have it grow and continue to be something that reaches people in a way that makes them want to donate is always very, very cool when that happens. So thank you for those donations. So, hey, guys, thank you again, and we'll just wish you good night.
Hey, good night, and Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year. Yes.
Happy New Year.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.